This podcast is brought to you by Radio Reverb. If you like what you hear, please support us by donating online at radioreverb.com.
The What's the Crack podcast with Anthony Martin.
Listen in live weekly on Brighton's Radio Reverb.
See whatsthecrack.co.uk and radioreverb.com for showtimes.
We're only a few days away now from the start of this year's Brighton Fringe Festival. And as always, there's a pile of Irish shows to choose from. Now, Dublin playwright Eddie Alford is putting on a four-day run of his show, Love in the Harbour, which is a love story set in World War I, following the lives of three Irish members of the Royal Flying Corps. It runs on the 23rd and 24th of May, and again on the 28th and 29th of May at Rialto Theatre on Dyke Road. And Eddie is here to tell us more. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, Ant.
So, what's this play about?
Well, there's a love story, which is fiction, and there's World War I pilots, three Irish air aces, top aces in the Royal Flying Corps, and that's real. That was real. That's fact. Most of that is fact. And an Irish guy who joined up, a guy called George McElroy, he joined up with his motorbike in 1914 as a dispatch rider, and he's my hero. And he was a dispatch rider for a year, and then they promoted him to a lieutenant in the field, and he was in the trenches, and he was gassed by the Germans in the trenches, sent home to Dublin. So in 1916, there was a rising in Dublin, and George was told to bring out a brigade of men and shoot the rebels, and he refused.
So this is based on true story, kind of from World War One.
Yeah, and he was dispatched for garrison duty, which was terribly tedious for these officers. And the only places he could have gone were either Cork or Birr, which was Crinkelin Birr, which was a massive base, British Army base. It had Canadian Army there. It had the Dublin Fusiliers, the Royal Irish Regiment. And that's 20 minutes away from where I live in Shannon Harbour. And George was a great fisherman because his grandfather had land in Roscommon and had taught him how to fish. So he was bored. And I so the fiction bit is I had him coming out to Shannon Harbour on his motorbike, which is only a 20-minute run, and meeting up with this receptionist in the hotel. The hotel is now ruined, but it was a working hotel in those days. And they fall for each other. And the woman's brother is an IRA man, and he tries to kill George. I think, and I play that part, I'm good at playing baddies. I'm not very good at all the things.
It's an interesting kind of, I suppose, topic really, because we're talking about Irish people that were in the British Army. Yeah.
I'll give you a little number. Before World War One, there were 200,000 men enlisted in the British Army. 100,000 of them were Irish.
And what kind of, I suppose, you've obviously done some research into this. What kind of, what did they deal with from Irish people back home? Were they treated as traitors, or were their decision to join the British Army respected?
Up to World War One, it was highly respected. I mean, Sean O'Casey, the great Dublin playwright, his brothers fought in the Boer War, and one of his brothers fought in World War One, volunteered. People, because there was a guy called John Redmond, he was an MP, and he said that Asquith would give Ireland their freedom from the Commonwealth, they'd be part of the Commonwealth, but freedom to rule themselves if the war ended and they won the war. So a lot of people bought into that. But the old Irish Republican Brotherhood, which became the IRA, they didn't want to know. They wanted to rule Ireland as a republic, completely separate from England, and because they were fed up of being lied to, etc., as politicians. Not that I would say politicians lie occasionally. So that was the background. So any guys in the British Army, they do their 10, 15, 20 years, and if they weren't killed, and a lot of them, some of them were killed, but not huge amounts, they intermarried with Irish people, or the English guys were intermarried with the Irish women. The Irish guys were treated, and it was treated as a really good job because there was a pension. And when these guys left, they were able to buy a shop or a pub. And the names, say, in Birr, near me, there's English names who had intermarried with Irish women on the names of the pubs and the shops.
Right, so quite a common kind of thing then.
Oh, it was very, very common, yeah, because there was no work, there was nothing there. As we know from famine days, there was, you know, you could either dig spuds, grow grain on a big farm, or fish.
So where did your interest in this subject and this area kind of develop from?
Ah, well, I went to University College Dublin for a couple of years. My family decided I was to do veterinary surgery, and I'm not a scientist. I'm an artist. I'd actually got a place to do English, Gaelic, Latin and geography, because that's what I was good at. So I dropped out. I learned how to play poker very well. So my dad put me in the car, drove me up to Belfast and said, right, get in there, the RAF recruiting office, sign up. And I signed up for 5 years. Now, they were supposed to put manners on me. Well, obviously they failed. But the RAF was a very interesting organisation, because I thought I'd had a hard time there, but I didn't, because I played a lot of sport. I never worked on a Wednesday afternoon. I travelled the world. I went to America, Hawaii, the South Pacific. I lived in Singapore for about 6 months. I lived in Darwin, Australia for another 6 months. So I'd actually, when I thought about it, I had a ball. And then because I'd served in the RAF for 3 years, I got a grant to go to university. They paid my university fees, and I got a grant of, I think it was 300 quid a year in the late 70s, a lot of money.
Yeah. So it stood you very, very well then.
Well, it did, and I hadn't realised. It was only when I started writing stuff that I realised, God, I had a great time there. These guys facilitated me getting back to university and doing drama.
This is your eighth production at the Fringe, isn't it?
It is, yeah. People are beginning to tell me now that I'm prolific, but I love it. You know, when I was a kid in primary school, we used to get two essays, one in Irish, one in Gaelic, which we call Irish, and one in English. And I get the titles, and my mother would be saying, you haven't done the essays, you haven't done, and I go, I'm thinking about them. And on Sunday night, I'd go up to my room at 7 o'clock after dinner, and I'd crash out the two essays, and I always got really high marks, and I found it very easy. And what was happening, and I realised later, because I do it, if I'm in Kerry and I'm writing, I write for 2 hours, and I go for a walk on the beach, and I talk to myself, I know, yeah, it's all right, and daydream, and have dialogue going on in my head. Then I'll go back. If I'm doing a play like this play, I had to research it for 6 months to let everything sink in, and then I just sat down and smashed it out. So I did an MA in writing up here at Sussex. So they taught us. They said, we're not going to teach you how to write. You know how to write. We're going to teach you about the craft, about deadlines, about cutting, about not being worried that somebody doesn't like some of your lines or some of your work. Just you need a hard neck and just get on with it. But you need to be very disciplined. If you missed one deadline, you were off the course.
So this play then, it's a mix of obviously the story that you were mentioning a bit earlier on, but it's also got music in it as well, is that right?
That's right, yes. It's got music written by John Merrigan and his partner Danielle. They were very interested. Funnily enough, we met here in Ant's studio when those two were recording some music. And Ty, who's the chair of the Irish Society in Brighton, was here doing a little PR work with Ant. And that's where it started. That was 2 years ago. And they just went for the play big time. They think it's great. And in fact, I'm going tomorrow to see them. And they've laid down the tracks. And then the following week, they're going to lay down the words.
That's great. So how many original songs are going to be in this play?
I think about 1, 2, 3. There's 4, but there's also some bits of original music as well. And I've been down there when Danielle and John, they've got a studio in the garden and they're playing away, and I'm hearing this stuff, and it's just great. I'm delighted with it.
Great. So it should be a great play, a great show in store for anyone who goes along. And again, it's 4 dates across the end of May at the Rialto Theatre on Doig Road. How's the final kind of preparation and directing going?
Oh, yeah, the usual, running around like a headless chicken, but I love it. And it's gone really well, and I've got a very strong cast. I'm really very pleased. And we've still got 3.5 weeks to go, so we're right on schedule. I've been doing this. I used to teach in drama and theatre in a big FE college, so I did that for 20 years, and then I've been doing this for another 8 years. So I'm pretty well know where I'm at when it comes to production.
Perfect. Well, listen, the best of luck with it. And I'm sure it'll go down a treat. It's called Love in the Harbour and it plays 23rd, 24th of May and again on the 28th and 29th of May at the Rialto Theatre on Dyke Road. And you can buy the tickets by heading over to brightonfringe.org. Eddie, best of luck with it.
Thank you very much, Anne.
You've been listening to a Radio Reverb podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and review. And to hear more podcasts like this, check out radioreverb.com.